Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Thanks so much for listening to Connecting Faith. Programs like this are possible thanks to listeners like you. You can find out more about supporting Faith Radio on our website, faithradionet.com.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Hi, thanks for tuning in. I'm Neil Stavem, and I want to just mention at the outset we were looking forward to talking to Jim Nikodem today, getting some prayer coaching. He came down with a flu bug and so was unable to be here, but I had an opportunity just yesterday to talk to Pastor Tim Keller, and I'm looking forward to sharing that interview with you for a little bit. We had a short time to spend together, and then the second half of the show, we're going to invite you to call in and spend some time talking about Faith Radio. So let's hear today's visit as we talk Center Church. You're listening to Connecting Faith, and I'm looking forward to spending some time today talking about how we do church and how it can be done significantly in the cities of our world. In fact, we're looking forward to spending some time with Pastor Timothy Keller. Tim's founding pastor, Redeemer Presbyterian Church in Manhattan, and he started that in 1989 with his wife, Kathy, and their three sons. And for over 20 years, he's led a diverse congregation of young professionals. It's grown to a weekly attendance over 5,000. He's also president of Redeemer City to City, which starts new churches in New York and other global cities, and publishes books and resources. And that's one of the reasons we're talking today, because there's a new resource out that Tim has just written. He's a best-selling author, books including The Reason for God, The Prodigal God. And we're excited to talk about the latest called Center Church, Doing Balanced Gospel-Centered Ministry in Your City. And Tim, in the introduction of the book, you talk about, you know, as you look at ministry in the center of global cities, you say it's the highest priority for the church. Why is that? What's different about global cities?
Well, I think I would nuance that to say it has to be a priority. I mean, I think the way in which I think I can say this the most balanced and brief way would be to say that while we need to have churches everywhere there are people, everywhere there's people, we need to have churches. But the people of the world are moving into cities faster than the churches, far faster than the churches. And therefore, if you're falling behind, that is to say, if you know, people are moving in every month, millions of people around the world are moving into the cities. Millions. Every month. And if we're not, unless you're planting, you know, hundreds or thousands of churches every month in the cities, you're just not even maintaining the status quo. You're not even maintaining the level of church for the people that we had before. So if that's the case, and I make the case in there, then it has to be a priority. I mean, when I say priority, I just mean it's something of a crisis. So I don't say cities are more important than the country, or you need to have, you know, it's more important to minister in the city than the country, as if the people of the city are more important than the people of the country. What I'm saying is the city is tremendously underserved by the church and rapidly becoming more and more underserved, and therefore the churches and denominations and missions agency ought to see that and respond to it and make it more of a priority than it ever has been.
You do talk, though, in the book about geography and I guess how that affects culture and the community.
Yes.
I think sometimes we just, you know, we are sort of we assume we're sort of homogenized and it's all the same wherever we are.
Yeah, and I say on top of the fact that you just have more people in the city, going into the city, and we just have fewer churches for them. On top of that, cities are becoming more important than they've ever been. That is, they are really, partly because of technology and mobility, things that go on in the cities spread faster and more pervasively. Cultural trends, innovations, they spread much more quickly. So it used to be people in Iowa were not affected by what happened in New York City, but that's just not true anymore. And so if you care about how human life is lived in this world at all and wanting to have any kind of effect on that, you certainly would want to go to cities, too. So that, I put that in as an additional reason why cities should be a priority, yes.
You were pastoring, a small church in Pennsylvania for a while before you started Redeemer. Talk a little bit about maybe just your transition, kind of the process that you you know, because much of what you're writing about in the book Centered Church is really, you know, a culmination of a lot of years of maybe trial and error.
Yeah. Now, I'm from Pennsylvania. The church was in a small town in Virginia.
Okay.
But by process. I mean, when I came, I had no experience with ministry in cities at all, and I just had to learn as I went. That's all. So the Center Church book is not simply my experience, because over the last few years, Redeemer has helped a lot of other churches and church pastors and church planters in other big cities of the whole world. And so this book is also learning from them and their experiences as well. So it's not just a New York-centric book.
You do spend some time talking about the idea of Center Church is that there's a balance, and I think you mm-hmm. described there's sort of three core commitments. So maybe talk a little bit about that and why the balance is so vital.
Well, it starts with the three core commitments are gospel, city, or culture. The gospel, bringing the gospel to the city and the culture, and then finally, being a catalyst for a movement in your city. So it's gospel, city, movement. The balance, and it's where the word Center Church comes from, the balance starts with the gospel, because the gospel is neither legalism, I can save myself through my good works, it's not legalism and moralism and Phariseeism, but on the other hand, it's not relativism. It's not like now I can live any way I want. Because the gospel of grace is that I'm saved by grace, not by my works, but a truly changed life means I want to please God, and it changes, you know, my heart, to it changes my behavior. Now, there's a balance there. So the gospel is not really legalism or relativism. That's a remarkable balance. Almost everything else in the world, pretty much everything else in the world is one of those two things. The gospel is unique. Then I just move on out and say, well, what that means then is when you bring the gospel to a culture, you're not like the moralist, afraid of the culture, withdrawn from it, totally negative about it. Nor, on the other hand, are you like the relativist, just imbibing it and picking it up and just, you know, going into it whole hog. But you're, again, you're critically engaging it. And then when you get to movement means, on the one hand, the moralism usually makes you very institutionalized. All the emphasis on authority and orthodoxy and sticking with the program and tradition, and this is the way we do things. But the relativist side tends to say everything should be fluid and there shouldn't be any rules and we should just do everything in a spontaneous way and it should be very organic. And what I try to say, again, a gospel-centered, if you're gospel-centered, it gives you a critical, balanced approach to culture, and it gives you both, keeps you from the extreme of being anti-institutional or being institutionalized. So by starting with the balance of the gospel, I just take it on out into the way in which the culture is engaged, the way in which the church is organized, and try to find that center.
You talk, there are many resources available that focus on church growth, church planting, all
yeah.
those things. And this seems like there's the two sort of main areas. It's focused on what we believe, sort of that theological side, or what we should do. How come it's so hard to maybe find that middle ground?
Well, everybody has the middle ground. It's just that what I try to do in the book is try to make it conscious, so that people are recognizing that they move from their doctrine to their program through a middle ground of thinking about your time and place. So, for example, quick example is, let's just say here's two churches, and they're both like Lutheran churches. They're both conservative Lutheran churches. They believe the old confession and statements of faith. So they have the same doctrine, right? But one of them is very contemporary and uses contemporary music and has screens and video clips and extremely informal. Everybody dresses very informally. And the other is very traditional, you know, classical music and hymns and an organ and very, very formal. And you say, wait a minute. They have the same doctrine. How did they get to two totally different sets of ministry programs? And the answer is that one of them thinks of the culture as almost completely toxic and something to totally, completely reject and stay away from. And the other one sees the culture as a very good thing to embrace and adapt to. Now, did they really think that out theologically? I doubt it. My guess is that they saw a church that they liked or they had a certain temperament. I think most people do not do the conscious thinking in that middle space, but they just assume things. They pick up, they see another ministry that they like and they copy it. And so I would say, I'm not trying to say that you, that middle space is what brings you from your doctrine to your program, but most people don't actually think it out and they just move through it blindly. And I'm trying to make it conscious, and that's what the whole book is about. Mm.
Does a lot of it have to do with the personality of the pastor? I mean, I guess I'm thinking that, you know, if the pastor is really relationally effective, then they're going to have sort of a bent one way or the other.
So. I'm afraid so. Instead of letting your theology influence the way in which you read the culture, there's a tendency to let your psychology and your temperament do it. I mean, I can see it in my own children. I probably better be careful here. I'm an older man, so my children are all grown. But, I mean, I can see some people just naturally are more, the culture is guilty till proven innocent. And other people, it's innocent till proven guilty. It's a temperament. It's just a natural way to meet a new situation. And, in fact, some people are extroverted, some people are introverted. You know, the introvert tends to be suspicious of the new situation or wait and react to it. And the extrovert's out there trying to, engage it right away. And I'm afraid very often it's our temperament that determine how we deal with the culture in the moment rather than really letting our theology affect us.
Tim Keller is founder and senior pastor of Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York City. He's a best-selling author. His latest work is called Center Church, Doing Balanced Gospel-Centered Ministry in Your City. Tim Keller is founder and senior pastor of Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York City. He's my guest today. Tim, talk about how we measure success in church today.
Well, I talk about the fact that I don't think it's right for us to talk about a ministry being successful for fear that that would reduce ministry to what they would call nickels and noses. You know, I've got more people coming and I got a bigger budget. But I'm a little afraid of overreacting to that and saying all that matters is we be faithful. Because the Bible does talk a lot about fruit. You know, Paul says, I'm coming to Rome because I want to see some fruit among you. And the book of Acts talks about the gospel, the word of the Lord multiplied and grew. So it's almost like it's got this power in it to change lives, convert people, grow people. So I'm a little afraid that when people say, I'm faithful, I'm just preaching the word faithfully. I don't even care about success because they're reacting to the success model rightly. But when they talk about faithfulness, sometimes what it really means is I don't have to evaluate whether I'm really changing anybody with my preaching, or I don't have to evaluate whether anybody's getting converted by what we're saying. So I would prefer to talk about fruitfulness. And what I really want to see is at the beginning, change lives where people who are getting converted and they're really letting the gospel change the way in which they think about things. And then as agents out there, you should see people doing good deeds in the city and integrating their faith with their work. So I actually lay out, especially in the chapters on integrative balance, what fruitful ministry looks like. But I really do want to stay away from too much emphasis on how big your church gets, honestly. Because in many cultures, a church that's got 150 people is a mega church and probably has done tremendous evangelism and maybe sees more changed lives than a church in the middle of America that has grown to 1,500 people in 5 years. I've seen plenty of churches in Europe with 150 people that have actually been a more fruitful ministry than a church of 1,500 in America, where they've basically drawn people from the other churches because their programs are better.
Yeah. You know, we often hear about the early church in the Roman world. They attracted so many non-believers. I'm wondering, can a pattern like that be repeated today? What will attract today? Maybe just use Redeemer Press as an example.
It's a hard question, and I'm afraid my answer, I don't want it to go on too long. I've had people, recently I had somebody come to Redeemer who had never been there, and afterwards wrote about it and said what amazed him was how simple it was. There were no screens. No screens of any sort. No screens for, no clips, no, you know, art up there, no, you know, words on the screen. There was no, it was very low-key. It was fairly liturgical. I get up there in a coat and tie. And yet the place was filled, and it was filled with young people. And the guy said, I don't get it. Where's the dancing bears? Where's all the stuff that makes you relevant? And the answer is, if you know the people well enough, and that they find that as you're talking to them, you can describe their innermost thoughts and their beliefs, and you can make a case for Christianity that they find compelling, even if they don't buy it and go with it, but they still feel the force of it. Then you have, you have made contact, and you will see some fruit. And it really isn't in the trappings. It's not in the how you look.
Just to follow up on that a little bit. Describe a little bit more about the community and what you're serving. I mean, I think we're fascinated by just what you said. So how can that be that it's not, you're in a high profile area, and yet it's seems kind of traditional.
Yeah, it's a fairly traditional church. When you actually come in, everybody thinks, my goodness. On the other hand, the community is highly professional. It's a mixture of, it tends to be single. I mean, our church is still about two-thirds single. Because that's basically who lives in Manhattan. Most people are single. So we have thousands of people, but most of them are single. And also, they tend to be younger. They tend to be ridiculously credentialed. That is to say, they have so many degrees and things like that. At one point, we actually did a survey and discovered, this is some years ago, that 15 to 17% of everybody who came to Redeemer either had a doctorate or was working on it, which is a real high percentage. And that's the reason why they're very secular people, very sophisticated, educationally sophisticated. They don't really like slickness. They really aren't looking for, in fact, they don't want to be sold something. They don't want to feel like they're being sold something. It's really much better just to be very direct in your language and the way in which you talk about things and the way in which you do things is recognizable to them. You get rid of the pious talk and the jargon that evangelical Christians have. You know, the way in which you pray, you use all these kinds of spiritual terms that are off-putting. You show them that you're reading the same books and you're watching the same movies, and you know what they're afraid of and what they believe, and you try to show them the contradictions in their beliefs, and they appreciate it, and you do it with respect. I don't know. I mean, this is what you do everywhere, except that we adapted to an unusually educationally sophisticated place. But it really wasn't that different than my church in Virginia. In a blue collar, I had to do it's basically the same process. You find out where the people are living, and you make sure you bring the gospel home to their hearts in ways that they can understand and with arguments that they can feel.
Which is what you're presenting clearly and from a number of different facets in the book's Center Church, doing balanced gospel-centered ministry in your cities. The latest from Tim Keller is published by Zondervan. I'm interested, you talk about jargon. I don't know if it's jargon, but the word missional is very popular today.
Yeah.
Talk about how maybe we've missed some of the balance there as well.
Yeah, it is. And, of course, a lot of people don't want to use it anymore. I decided to stick with it. Not that I would use it with people in the church. I mean, this is a book for practitioners. I do think that there's something to be said for the idea that because we live in a post-Christian Western culture, in some ways the first culture, most places in the world, the church is living in pre-Christian cultures. In other words, in China and in Latin America and Africa, these are places where the culture is not Protestant Christian, and now the Protestant Christianity is growing. We live in a post-Christian culture, and I think it's fair to say that rather than just simply being a church that does missions, we need to be missional, and that is we need to figure out how everything about our church today in the West is takes into consideration that we're actually on a mission field again. And I really think for years the Western Church assumed the mission field was over there, and that most of the people we talked to here were kind of Christianized. I mean, they needed to be born again, but they basically had Christian concepts of things. And that's all changed. And so I like the word missional because it's trying to ask the question, what is a missional church? It doesn't just mean an evangelistic church, but a church that is actually engaging with secular post-Christian Western people. So that's what I try to answer there. I still like the word because I feel like it's getting at something that we still need to figure out.
You know, I know it, as I was reading the book, I guess I was thinking a lot about just the real estate, you know, theory about, you know, it's location, location, location. Does that make that much of a difference? So if you were pastoring in Virginia, now you're in New York City, or if someone's in Minneapolis and now they're in Dallas, or you know, rural to urban, I mean, how big a geography makes the difference, I guess?
Well, big difference, because the whole contextualization means adapting the gospel communication without compromising it, without compromising its truth. If you compromise its truth, you've over-contextualized. If you don't adapt at all, you've under-contextualized. So, yes, I mean, obviously, I'm still talking about sin and grace. I'm still telling everybody they're sinners, that they're alienated from God. They need to be reconciled with a holy God. They have to be, that's only done through the substitutionary death of Jesus Christ, and by putting your faith in him, you're now, there's no condemnation for you who are in Christ Jesus, and you're saved by grace and by faith. I say that no matter where I go in the world. I don't change any of that. But how I say it changes quite a lot. A lot. And that's all. So, of course, geography makes a big difference. It's social location particularly, not just physical geography.
Just cultural, yeah, the culture in which we're accustomed, right, of where
yeah.
we live. Yeah.
Absolutely. So it's... I mean, my put it this way, my parents' generation, all the non-Christians out there, all still knew that they needed to be good. They needed to be really good people. And they define goodness largely the way a Christian would, that I shouldn't commit adultery, and, you know, people shouldn't have sex outside marriage, and, you know, you need to be honest, and you need to be hardworking, and you need to honor your parents and all that stuff. So the average non-Christian believe they should be good, and they conceived of good largely in ethical terms like Christianity. So when you preach the gospel to them, you could take all that into consideration. And when you said to them, what you basically had to say to them is, you think you should be good, and you're right, but you're not good enough. And then you have to, you know, bring the conviction to them and say, and only through Christ can you actually be acceptable in God's sight. With my children's generation, you couldn't say you need to be good. They say, who's to say what good is? They do not see that that is the main thing they need to get to. They would say the meaning of life is not to be good, but to be free. And then what I have to do there is I have to preach to the non-Christians and say, you think you should be free, and you're right, but guess what? You're not. You are not free. You are in bondage, and only through Christ will you be free. So now, it's the same gospel, but what you're doing is you are bringing it to bear on two different ways of understanding, you know, there's two different ways of trying to convict them of sin, because it depends on what they think about the meaning of life is. So you've got to start with something they believe, which is right, and then you've got to show them where they're inconsistent and wrong. And that's why gospel presentations will be very different depending on the belief system of the people you're trying to reach.
But as you say, there's the presentation, I think, where there's, you know, there's lots of discussion these days, too, about, well, you know, we don't have to use words all the time. But, I mean, you make that pretty clear, right?
Yeah, of course you have to use words. I mean, the trouble is when people say, preach the gospel, use words when necessary, I can show people a good life, but that'll only make them say, oh, you're really a good person. I really respect you. What do you believe? I mean, in other words, my good life would only lead them to want to believe what I believe, and I have to tell them, and I have to use words. So I do think it's a huge oversimplification and maybe misleading to say you don't need to verbally present the gospel.
Tim Keller, founder and senior pastor of Redeemer Presbyterian Church. The book we've been talking about is called Center Church.